warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
This episode, we celebrate the weaving teacher, those wonderful people who share their talents and knowledge with the rest of us. We have the results of the Teach a Friend to Weave contest, and we'll be hearing some of your stories. We'll take a tour of the weaving school on Whidbey Island and talk to talented teachers Madeline Vanderhoot and Peggy Osterkamp. But first, some good news.
We had three applicants for the grant this year, and the juror was Linda Ligon of Interweave Press. I'd like to read what she had to say about the entries. All of these proposals had merit, but in my judgment, proposal number two was the one likely to create the largest reverberations in the weaving community and bring the greatest enrichment to the most people. It is a very compelling proposition. So proposal number two was Sine Mitchell's proposal for funding to continue her talk radio show devoted to weaving. And here's what Linda had to say about Sine's proposal. Her concept is splendid in filling a long-standing need for documentation of contemporary hand weaving and giving back to her guild and her community abundantly. And while the results are not weaving, the creative component is no less real or important. So Sine.
So that was Eileen O'Connor speaking at the Seattle Weavers Guild meeting in April. And as you heard, I got some grant funding, which I am just delighted about. I'm grateful that the Seattle Weavers Guild allowed me to play that clip for you because you're a huge part of this grant. If you look at the proposal, there are charts of listener statistics and how they've grown over time. There are excerpts from the comments. There are pictures of listeners from the Frapper map. There are charts that show the donations that have come in and how listeners are really behind the show. And all of this is what convinced the juror that Weavecast could really make a difference in people's lives. So thank you for all the various ways that you have helped support the show. Now, two great things are going to be able to happen because of the grant. First of all, I am partially funded now to go to Convergence in Tampa in 2008. So if you're going to Convergence, which is the largest gathering of weavers in the world and happens every other year, hopefully I can meet some of you. If you're not going to Convergence, I'm going to be reporting on the conference and bringing as much of it as I can back to the show. Either way, you're going to get to go to Convergence with me. Because this grant is funding operating expenses for 2007, I was able to free up some of the money that had come in via donations to buy some field recording gear. I had been using a really old laptop that had a tendency to crash. More than one occasion, I have completely lost an interview. And if you can imagine anything more nerve-wracking than asking someone for an interview, imagine having to ask for it twice. In fact, this interview with Madeline Vanderhoot was one of the ones that after talking to her for an hour and a half, the computer crashed, and I ended up getting only 7 minutes of audio. Fortunately, I had learned from my past experiences, and I had a little tiny iRiver sitting on a table recording everything we said, so I didn't lose the content of the interview. I use the audio from the iRiver, even though it's not the best sound. You'll actually hear there's a clip in the middle where the sound gets really good for a minute. That's the part that didn't get destroyed when my laptop crashed. And then it goes back to the old stuff. The new field recording gear is amazing. It's about the size of a paperback book, and it's not lovely. But what it is reliable and foolproof. It's a wonderful piece of equipment and has beautiful sound. In fact, I'm using it to record the narration for this show. So thank you, everyone who donated. Thank you, Seattle Weavers Guild, for funding my operating expenses for 2007 and helping me find money to get to Convergence. I just can't believe how much support I'm getting from the weaving community for this project, and I really appreciate all of it. Thank you. And speaking of people who help support the show, we've got a new sponsor this episode, Heritage Spinning and Weaving. They're located in Michigan and carry looms, weaving supplies, and yarn. So if you're in that area, please stop by and support your local weaving store. They also have a wonderful website at www.heritagespinning.com. In addition to supplies, they sell weaving kits. They sent me a sample of one of their kits, which makes a log cabin scarf in 100% silk. The kit comes with two skeins. One is black and the other is hand-painted. And they have a variety of colorways. The one I got was Sunset, which is a vibrant pink and yellow, which I just loved. And they also offer blues, greens, yellows, and a gorgeous burgundy blend. And what was funny about getting this kit is I've been wanting for some time to try a color and weave project that has black as the dark and a hand-painted skein as the light, just to see how the colors would mix. So I can't wait to try this out. Though, being somewhat bad about following directions, I may change from log cabin to a different shadow weave pattern. The kit comes with everything you need. The silk is soft and lustrous, and it comes in two different weights. Both are beginner friendly. One is 2,000 yards per pound and the other is 3,000 yards per pound. So we're talking a set of about 16. They have three different kits that they offer right now. One is the log cabin scarf. There's one that does rainbow blocks, which is a variation of overshot. And then there is an 8-shaft plaited twill kit that I am seriously lusting after. Great weaving supplies and a super friendly owner, I am just delighted to have Heritage Spinning and Weaving as this episode's sponsor. Laura Fry, who was our guest on episode 10 and who generously donates her time to do the transcripts for Weavecast, has started an online study group. Her first topic is towels. If you'd like to join, go to her website at www.laurafry.com and click on the education link, and we'll have a link to that on the show notes. Matter update. This fall, in a fit of frustration at a poor harvest, I attacked my matter bed with a shovel and tilled the soil viciously. This was apparently the right thing to do. I have to say that the matter is leaping out of the bed this spring like crazy, so I'll keep you up to date and let you know how the harvest goes this fall. In July, I'm going to have another class at the Weaving Works. This is July 8th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. I'll be teaching rigid heddle weaving again, and this is a hands-on class, so if you have a rigid heddle loom and you're in the Seattle area, I invite you to come check it out.
Teaching and learning are the same things. I mean, when teaching is a learning experience, because you have, in order to teach, you have to examine the thing very closely, so you're learning yourself what its nature is.
This April, I taught my first private lesson, and it was great fun. Two women split the cost of hiring me as a private tutor to show them how to use a loom that they'd borrowed. I brought over a variety of wools for them to play with and let them build up stripes on the warping board, designing as they went. It was a very simple, easy way to get started. Warping went smoothly, and then it was time to weave. That's where we ran into trouble. The loom was one that I'd never used before, a Harrisville direct tie-up folding loom. And when you press down on the treadle to get a shed, it hit a wooden brace, so the treadle wouldn't go all the way to the floor. And the shed was something like a half inch. Not good. So I crawled under the loom and saw that there were dents worn into the wooden brace. Obviously, somebody had been weaving with it in that condition. But I knew that Harrisville was a good company, and I couldn't believe that they'd make a loom that was that hard to weave on. So I checked to make sure that the loom was fully unfolded, and it was, and I looked all over, and finally, I looked at how the treadles had been attached to the loom, and I realized that they were assembled wrong. So we unscrewed the treadles, flipped around the bar that affixed them to the loom, reattached them, and voila, a beautiful shed. We had a good laugh about it and joked that that's probably why the woman was willing to loan them the loom and why that woman had never really taken to weaving. I can't believe that she had actually been able to weave on it with a half-inch shed. I call this my Judith McKenzie moment, since on more than one occasion, the first thing Judith has had to do when sitting down to teach me something is fix my equipment. I learned two things that day. If the weaving is hard, make sure it's not something wrong with the loom, and always pack a screwdriver in your teaching kit. In early May, I volunteered to teach weaving at my son's preschool. I warped up a shot table loom with crochet cotton that my son and I had hand-painted in beautiful blues and greens. Now, I love crochet cotton for teaching kids because it's cheap and bulletproof. I took a tip from an article by Jane Patrick in an old edition of Handwoven about weaving with kids and used rubber bands to make one lever out of levers 1 and 2 and another out of 3 and 4. So instead of having 4 levers to deal with, they just had 2 big levers. The kids each got a turn weaving 3 to 4 picks, and then I showed them the magic trick that happens if you forget to change the shed when you weave, and they loved it. In fact, many of them thought that unweaving was the funnest part, and they had me do that over and over again. At the end of the day, I left the loom at the school, and I told the teacher that she could keep it for as long as the students were interested in it. The next day, she told me the loom had been in constant use since I'd left it, and it continues to be a big hit. That's my experiences of teaching to weave this spring. Now let's listen to one of yours. This is Karen Madigan from Australia.
Hi, Sign. Firstly, I just want to say how much I absolutely love your podcasts. I'm out there in the studio often listening to them. It makes my weaving go faster, more efficient, and much more creative, I think. I'm also responding to your challenge to teach someone to weave in the month of March. I thought about this at first and thought, well, perhaps I wouldn't be able to partake because I'm not actually teaching anyone. But when you mentioned that we can teach ourselves, well, I have. After 27 years of weaving, I am still so excited about every thread I put on the loom. I can't begin to tell you just how much, or maybe I can begin to tell you because you'll already know just how much it has given me in my life. Not only has it taught me the structure of weaving and cloth and the drape and its uses, but it's also led me to other areas of study and work. For example, I'm very passionate about art and design, and through the world of textiles, I can view that much more intricately. I've learned much more about the history of the world through all the other cultures, through the eyes of their weaving, why they weave, why they use their textiles, how they use their textiles, and its importance in their cultures. I'm also interested in philosophy, the philosophy of weaving and textiles in cultures. I've learned more about maths, geometry, and symmetry. I've also been led to all other related textile arts, such as basketry and braiding, and of course knitting and all constructed textiles. Apart from all that, I've also been really stunned by human innovation. Humans are just amazing. Who would have invented tablet weaving, for example? It is fairly wacky and I can hardly figure it out, but someone invented it. Anyway, Sign, just to let you know that I'm not really cheating, I actually have got a new student. Her name's Megan and she's just raring to go with a new secondhand Leclerc 46-inch counterbalance loom. She's very excited about starting and I'm looking forward to teaching her. Thank you very much for everything.
And now let's talk about the Teach a Friend to Weave contest. I'm so excited. This went really well this year. We got 28 entries representing 137 new weavers taught. I'm just delighted. Reading through all these wonderful stories, I first had the idea that I would give 2 awards. One would be random and one would be for the best story. But the stories were all so good that I couldn't decide that this one was better than that one. So all of the prizes were awarded randomly. Many weaving teachers were honored in these stories, and I was flattered by the handful of folks who counted me as their teacher because listening to the podcast inspired them to weave. We're going to be hearing these stories over the next year. I'll be working them in. And if you enter the contest and you do not want your weaving story read on the air, please email me privately and I'll make sure that doesn't happen. I picked the winners by flipping a coin 5 times to generate a binary number. I used heads as 1, tails as 2, and flipped it 5 times. Our first winner was Nancy Alegria, and this just goes to show that good weaving karma pays off. Volunteering at her daughter's school, Nancy taught 64 school children to weave. You'll be able to hear her interviewing her weaving teacher at the end of this episode. The second winner is Linda in Windy Springlike, Southern Ontario. Sometimes in email, I don't get last names. And she had a friend with 2 daughters and she loaned them some simple looms. And she was only intending to teach her friend to weave, But the daughters got into it, so she ended up teaching all three of them to weave. So yay, Linda. And the third winner is Judy Cochran. And she was one of my students in my first rigid heddle class at Weaving Works. And I have a confession that I didn't tell those people. That was the first time I'd ever taught weaving. So I learned as much from them as they learned from me. And Judy was a total delight to have in class because she got bitten by the weaving bug bad. She's already moved on to a 400-ness loom, and I'm just delighted. She sent me some pictures of the work she's done since the class, and it's really cool. I'm also awarding three audio honorable mentions to Karen Madigan, Cynthia Teague, and Wacky Lisa. And I feel I have to mention, that's how she identified herself, not something I put on her. These three people didn't have their numbers come up in the random drawing, but I thought that it took a lot of gumption to actually send in audio, and that they deserve something for the extra effort. The prizes are a boat shuttle generously donated by Shack Spindle Company, a cotton or rayon warp wound and hand-painted by me, and if you choose this prize, we'll work out the color and other details later. I have from my own library some back issues of Weaver's Magazine and a copy of Weaving Tricks by Susan Gilmurray. And how this will work is that the first winner takes first pick, then the second winner, and so on. So that way, everybody has a really good chance of getting a prize that they will be delighted with. Because I was so impressed by all the stories, I'm going to offer a prize to everyone who entered. This is an iron-on decal with the WeaveCast logo and the words, Teach a Friend to Weave Contest 2007. Because it's an iron-on decal, you can decide whether you want a t-shirt and what size and what color, and you can decide if you'd rather have a canvas tote. But if you iron it on something and wear it, everyone will know that you helped add a few more weavers to the world. If you'd like to claim your iron-on prize, simply email me again and send me your mailing address. All contact info that you send to WeaveCast is kept in strict confidence, and if you have any questions, please reference the WeaveCast privacy policy, which is posted on the website. Thank you to everyone who entered. I'm delighted to hear all your stories, and I can't wait to share them over the course of the year. And congratulations, because you're all winners. When I contacted Madeline about an interview, she invited me to come up to her weaving school while the Weaving 2 class was in session and meet some of the students. What better way to get insight into the life of a weaving teacher than to see her in action? The top floor of Madeline's house is a normal house. Okay, perhaps there are more gorgeous hand-woven textiles than in the average house, but still, it looks like a regular house. But you walk down into the lower floor, and there are looms. There's one huge room that is just filled with looms. I didn't count them all, but it was some number between 20 and 40. Looms everywhere, gorgeous, well-tended looms. I arrived early and was able to sit in on one of Madeline's lectures about structure. It was great, packed full of information, and when they took a break, I got the joy of meeting some of the students.
My name is Joanne Hicken.
And where are you from?
I'm from Clinton, Washington, right here on Whidbey Island. I've been weaving for a little over 3 years.
My name is Tori, and I'm from Lummi Island, and this is the second Weaver's Workshop. Some of us came to the first one a month ago, so I'm a new weaver.
My name is Jane Moisey, and same as Tori, I came a month ago, so I'm a new weaver, and I live in Mount Vernon.
My name is Leslie Ray. I'm from McCall, Idaho, and I've been weaving for 5 years.
I'm Peggy Weaver. And I'm from McCall, Idaho also, and I'm a new weaver. I've been weaving for 2 or 3 years, and I just have a 4-shaft table loom, so it's fun using these 8-shaft looms here.
I'm Carol O'Ryan from Camino Island, Washington, and I've been weaving for less than a year.
Hi, I'm Mary Pendergast. I live in Seattle, Washington, and I'm a new weaver, and this is my second course with Madeline, and she's awesome.
And I'm Madeline Vanderhoot, and I'm teaching here.
As great as the lecture was, you can't really teach weaving without hands-on experience. So after lunch, the class moved on to demoing various weave structures on pre-warped looms. Once the students were off and working, I was able to sneak Madeline away for a quick interview.
How did I get started weaving?
I taught school in Oakland, California. We had a lot of Hispanic students there at the time, and they needed someone to plan a curriculum for Hispanic students. I applied to get the sabbatical to go to Mexico and Central America and maybe South America and prepare a course. I went with my husband to Southern Mexico. It's kind of hard to know what you would do to prepare a course, so you just travel. And we saw lots of textiles in the villages, especially in Oaxaca, and so we started getting very interested in them. We'd see a woman with something really gorgeous on, and then we'd think, we'll have to go to her village. And so we'd go to her village, and then we'd see something from some other village. We kept following them farther south, farther south, farther south, and then we saw the one that we thought was the most gorgeous weaving I ever had seen. And that came from a town in Guatemala named Neiva. And we went there, and I decided it would be really cool to learn how to weave the stuff that they were weaving. I went up to someone in the market and I said, could you find somebody who would teach me how to weave? And they said, sure, Chooch would teach you. So I said, okay, well, where's Chooch? And they gave me some directions. And so I went, and as I was on my way to find Chooch, I asked somebody else, well, could you tell me where I could find Chooch? And they would say, sure. And I'd keep going, only it would keep being in a different direction until I finally found out that Chooch meant mother in Ishiel. And so I was just looking for a mother. But I finally did find someone, and for 25 cents a day, I would go there and weave in her yard. And it was fabulous. They lived in family compounds where the son would bring his wife to live with the family. And there would be maybe four sons in an area, and they would all have their wives. And the youngest daughter-in-law always had to do all the work. The other women, the mother, the matriarch, and then the other husband's wives got to weave. And so we would sit around with our looms tied to pillars coming down from the houses, and we would weave and weave and weave. The youngest daughter-in-law would serve us coffee, and I loved it. My loom had tons of colored stripes. You would sit in front of it, so it would really be in front of your eyes, and I would watch all the things happening in the village through the striped warp. And then at night I would dream, and I would have all these colors would be in front of whatever it was I was dreaming. So it was great. I then came back and had to plan my course for Hispanic studies, which didn't have very much to do with weaving, and I had to plan the week after I got back for my whole year's work. And because we had lived in Guatemala with no conveniences at all, we decided that we really loved living without conveniences. We decided to go back to the land, and we went and ended up in Missouri, and we bought a house that had no electricity and no running water, and lived there. I saw weaving on a Dorothy table loom in a crafts fair, and I thought, gosh, people here can do that too. Missouri wasn't a good place to hook up your backstrap loom to a tree in the yard all year long. The table loom worked out, and I taught myself to weave, and I've been doing weaving ever since.
How did you get started with the weaving school?
Well, I've been growing looms, so I had more looms than my space.
Now, were you collecting them to teach, or just
I just liked a new loom every now and then. I was always on my path to weave a certain kind of coverlet, and I would get a loom, and then I would find out I couldn't really do it on that loom, so then I would get another loom, but I couldn't really do it on that loom, and so eventually I got a draw loom, and these looms were big and numerous.
Did you become a teacher just to justify the number of looms?
More or less. You have to say that's right. So I had the looms. Well, I could just imagine a little school with all the people weaving. So then in 1983, we bought the farm next door to us, and it had a house on it, a kind of not very great house. So I moved the looms all up to that house. In fall of 1984, I advertised in the Columbia newspaper, and I thought I might get some people from the nearby town. And I don't think I got anybody from there. I got somebody from New York, I got somebody from California, I got somebody from Arkansas, I got somebody, all the students who came to that first class were from far away. I kind of hoped people would come and go, not stay all night, because we had to supply room and board. So I cooked for them, and then they stayed in this not very great house. We had electricity. The running water was a pump in a freezer at a pond. One time that we're all sitting there and drinking water and eating lunch, and someone goes, gosh, you know, the water here is so great. Where does it come from? And my assistant and I try hard not to look out at the pond where the cattle and the sheep are standing in the water.
It's very flavorful.
Yeah, it's rainwater.
At one point.
And it was. Right. But it was great. I usually have 12 classes a year there, and it was a deeper experience because we all lived together for the week that they were there. It was like going to any kind of retreat where you're with people who you have a very lot in common, but they're not part of your regular life. People would be very personal and open, and we talked about things that were not weaving things, but things that were really mattered in your life.
I've seen pictures, so you have to tell me about the roof.
So I built the new building, and I designed it like an old schoolhouse, and it had a steeple with a school bell in it that rings. When I got to the roof part, I thought I should make this a weaving pattern. I had just been really doing a lot of double two-tie unit weave, so I thought I would make it a double two-tie plaited twill. If you did a drawdown of double two-tie plaited twill, you would notice that one black square would be just directly below a change from black to white right above it. So that would make you have to have a red shingle that had a white shingle directly above it, but the edges were at the same place. Well, shingles can't do that. So I mapped it all out in the roof, and I figured out all the places that you would have to put flashing underneath those join places. The guy that was going to do the roof came and looked at my design, and he said, ma'am, I mean, it was like 500 little bits of flashing all put in a little spot that you would have to know before you put the shingle down. And so he said, no, I won't do that. He would do a design that did not require him to cut any shingles except at the end of a row. It had to have no flashing. I redid the twill, and it ended up being six rows of red and white in a twill sequence, and then solid red, and then six rows of twill in sequence. And then I went and bought the shingles. He comes and he looks at the drawing and at my shingles, and I had gone up on the roof and drawn a line for every row because I didn't want him to beat wrong so that he gets to the top and there's not the six picks left. It would look really
You're
bad.
You're weaving your
roof. I know, I have to have it woven right. Nobody in my neighborhood would know, but the people who came would know. And if they didn't know when they came, they should know when they leave. So I have my two stacks of shingles, and he looks at the stacks of shingles and he says, ma'am, have you looked at this design? I mean, this design has a lot more red shingles than it does white shingles. I looked at it and I thought, I solved it like most weaving problems, and I just told him to do the other side the other way around. You look at one side of the roof and it's mostly red, and you look at the other side of the roof and it's mostly white, and it's looks cool on both sides, and you can't see them together anyway unless you're on in an airplane, which we did have occasionally. A crop duster would say, I saw that roof out there.
Why did you move from Missouri out to the West Coast?
After a while, I started also teaching workshops all around the country, and I did that for about 20 years. I came every September to what was called Fiber Forum, which was an event held here on Whidbey Island at Camp Casey. I'd leave Missouri, I'd get on the airplane, and I'd get off in Seattle and rent my car, and then I'd drive up on I-5, and then I'd get on the ferry, and then I'd drive up the island. And at that time, you would drive this tree canopy road all the way up the island. The idea of going someplace and you get to ride on the ferry, it was like, it was paradise. My business had not been healthy for my marriage. I got divorced. I could have lived in the school, which I still own, but living next door to your ex-husband really doesn't seem like a very good idea. I thought, well, God, I have the opportunity to move anywhere I want. This was the place I really loved.
Do you consider yourself primarily a structure weaver?
Definitely. That's my orientation, but actually what I like weaving now is not connected to structure at all. I like weaving with yarns that produce differential shrinkage and making textures with them. And I'm really fascinated by including color in that. So it's sort of like I became motivated by color and texture. Like right now, I don't weave on any of the complicated looms I have. I weave on the simplest looms and like it best. My theory is that people do start from a certain orientation on the kind of structure pattern to color texture line. And wherever they start, they move toward the other side because you're most comfortable with that point where you started, but you learn more and become more comfortable with the other aspects as you're there. And so for me, it's been a movement in that direction. In weaving, there are people who are really attracted to the engineering and structural aspects of it, and people who are attracted to the tactile aspects. I saw it right away in my very first classes when I'd have people tell about themselves. There would be people who would say,
Well, why I became a weaver is I have this friend and she had these fleeces and they were so soft. And so I learned how to spin and then I learned how to weave and I got a 48-inch loom with four harnesses. And then there'd be somebody who'd say, I went to AVL and I saw their looms and I thought, golly, I have to have one of those. And they're just attracted for different reasons. And you can tell the difference by the way they weave, like the color texture. People are gentle and they don't like to hurt the thread and they have loose tension and they don't throw
anything or slap anything in the structure pattern. People have tight tension and they're into control and they whop the beater and they, it's just a difference that has many aspects. And a lot of people don't like being put in either one of those two boxes. Those are mostly actually the structure pattern people don't like being put in a box. But it was important to me to figure that out because the color texture people have a lot of trouble with the language and math of weaving. It isn't really math like mathematical numbers, but there's a sort of geometry to weaving. Even fixing the looms, so many elements of it are mathematical or technical. And then there's the completely separate element of weaving, the tactile, soft threads, the beautiful colors, the looking out of the window at the trees. I mean, all that's just a different part. Everybody likes both parts, but you're sort of bent is one or the other.
I think that's what I love most about weaving, is it fully engages, you know, my right brain and my left.
There's exactly.
Like, ooh, pretty colors, soft things to touch, but then also complicated puzzles to figure
right.
out.
Right. Well, there's some people who don't like those complicated puzzles. And some people who, if you watched them, you would see that they're uncomfortable picking a color for something, and they're not really connected to the tactile aspects of weaving. You're lucky if both are sort of equally well-developed. If you're right-brained, it does help develop your left brain, and vice versa. I think it's the greatest activity.
What are you trying to impart when you're teaching?
I would like them to feel comfortable moving ahead to making choices on their own and not relying just on projects. I hope they could understand any information they needed to get from somewhere else. That would be my goal.
So you're trying to launch them.
In weaving one, I want to launch their love. And in weaving two, I want to launch their understanding. Because there are many things about weaving that can be intimidating. You join the guild and you go to guild meetings. And it's mostly the structure pattern people who do all the talking. And they talk about blah, 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 1, 5, 7, 9, 11, blah, blah, blah. And takate, blah, blah, blah. And it makes the people who are barely hoping they know what rose path is just feel intimidated and like, oh, well, I'm never going to be able to do that. So I better just stay and do plain weave because that's all I'm ever going to be able to do. And I don't want them to feel like that. I want them to see that it's really all knowable. When you first start to weave, one of the things that's really appealing about it is it just seems like you could never learn it all. But actually, the truth is you can. It's because you are limited to what those vertical things can do on a piece of equipment that's only capable of moving a certain number of them. I just want them to realize that they're going to be able to learn everything they need to know and they can do whatever they want.
I was really excited when I heard about this Weaving 2 class because it's really easy to find the beginning how
right.
to warp a loom class. But once you're comfortable warping a loom, there's not a lot out there for the intermediate
weaver. No, I know it. They're just workshops, which are good, but the trouble with them is there's one this, one that, one this, one that, and
yeah,
putting them all
narrow.
Together. In your weaving learning life, you spend most of your time putting together pieces of unconnected stuff. So it's like it would be nice if it were easier to do than that. I used to do Weaving 3 and 4. Weaving 3 would be way more designing and drafting yourself. Weaving 4 did it even more. I only had in Weaving 4 people with Weaving 3, and so then we just went deeper. It covered draw loom and dobby theory, which at the time there was a lot less knowledge about than there is now. I'd like to do that again. At times you had such experienced people there that it was way more like a seminar of sharing than it was lecture, learn.
Mm-hmm. I know what you're thinking at this point. Yes, Madeline Vanderhoot is a wonderful weaving instructor, but she's also the editor of Handwoven. And if I were you, I would be at home screaming, "Didn't you ask her any questions about that?" Yes, I did. And I'm saving that portion of the interview for an upcoming episode of Weavecast on weaving publications. If you'd like to hear the editor of Handwoven talk about what she's trying to accomplish with the magazine, what she looks for in submissions for articles and projects, stay tuned. And to wrap up our episode on weaving teachers, we have an interview with another wonderful teacher, Peggy Osterkamp. Now, I consider Peggy to be one of my teachers, even though I've never met her. She's written three wonderful books, Winding a Warp and Using a Paddle, Warping Your Loom and Tying on New Warps, and finally, Weaving and Drafting Your Own Cloth. And these three books are wonderful. They're informationally dense, and reading them and watching Peggy's video about how to warp your loom have made me a better, more efficient, and happier weaver. So I'm just delighted to have her on the show. And the interviewer is a guest interviewer. This is Nancy Alegria, who I met last year at Black Sheep Gathering, and she has been a student of Peggy Osterkamp's for many years, so I thought she would be the perfect person to do this interview.
Hey, this is Nancy Alegria. I'm here with Peggy Osterkamp, who I've had the pleasure of being in her class for the last 3 years.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
How did you get interested in weaving?
I had a sabbatical from teaching. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine was taking weaving over in Berkeley. And so I thought, oh, I'll do that. And I did, and I loved it. We had keys to the place, so I went day and night. So for a year, knowing I had a job to come back to, mm-hmm. I was just in heaven. I found a passion. Weaving has been my life since then.
Who was your first weaving teacher?
Pat McGaw. Mm-hmm. I went to Pacific Basin School of Textile Arts. Mm-hmm. And they learned from Truda Germanpre at College of Arts and Crafts. We talked a lot about structure. My projects in school were big wall hangings. Since then, I've done pretty small things because I just can't settle on one idea for very long. I mean, I'm finished with it, so I'm on to the next one, uh-huh. really.
What was the first loom you wove on?
Well, we had Lilistinas, and they're from Sweden, and they're a little table loom on legs. And she thought that it was important to use our hands for the levers when we're learning, so our hands and our brains and our everything was working together.
Oh.
Pretty soon, they knew I was a hotshot. I didn't know that, but they knew that, meaning my teachers. And so I was given the Ahrens loom right away.
What was the first loom you bought?
Early on, I got an Ahrens loom, 10 shafts, and I got it from him. And wow. I felt like a new mother when I got it. Ooh, what am I going to do with this?
Yeah, thing? 10 shafts. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, you were a student of Jim Ahrens, weren't you?
Yes.
How did that come about?
He came around at Pacific Basin, and he was, I think, 72 at the time, maybe mm-hmm. a little less. He kept looking at us and our work, and he'd say, well, you're doing that the hard way. And we were doing precisely what our teachers told us to do. Several of us really listened to him. And then they had an apprentice program where they built a studio, and we were there under his tutelage. John Violette, the brother of my teacher, Pat McGaw, was building looms. Jim was helping him build looms and giving him designs. That was the beginning of AVL. When the looms were made in the workshop, they'd come over to us, and then we would work on them. So it was like having a fairy godfather. Whenever there was a problem, we'd just call him up.
Well, that's where the name AVL came from, wasn't
right.
it? Yeah. Ahrens
and Violette looms.
You took a lot of what Jim taught you about warping to heart.
Yes.
Yes. Because you are now known as the queen of back-to-front warping.
You know, it's funny because I never expected that to be the important part. When I started teaching production techniques, I figured everybody could learn how to set up the loom however they wanted to, and then I would teach the other stuff, selvages and shuttles and weave motions and drafting. And then they kept wanting me to do the warping.
Well, when you first learned to warp, did you do front to back?
The very first time, but only one little summer class.
Okay.
But after that, at Pacific Basin, we went from the back and made two crosses and made a rattle cross. So there wasn't much different, really. The philosophy was the same.
Mm-hmm. So what prompted you to write your books?
During the year's apprenticeship with Jim, we had a folder called Chairman Jim. When a problem came up or a subject, he'd talk about it, and then I said, let's put all those little things in a file folder, and we did. And that's the basis for the book. I just felt that they were so important and different from anything that I'd learned or seen that they needed to be passed on. Carol Hillestad is co-author on the first book. She was wonderful.
What excites you about weaving?
You know, I've always liked the structure. If I go to an exhibit with someone, they'll say, oh, what a great elephant. I will not have seen the elephant. Mm. I'm looking at the toes or the tail or some little weaving where the threads are going.
You're looking at the details?
I'm always looking at the trees, not the forest. That's what I like. And I've been playing with color, so that excites me to be studying it and playing with it. It's always fun to learn something new.
So what kind of weave structures really excite you these days?
One of my mentors, Helen Pope, said, I complained early on. I said, you know, I just don't have a style. And she said, Peggy, you don't know enough yet. So I'm still writing on that so I can experiment. But I love double weave. I love overshot, damask. Now I've been intrigued and love hot because it's so easy to weave. I think its biggest problem is it goes too fast. I'm finding that I'm enjoying four-shaft things. You know, it's faster to thread, it's easier to weave. And I think people that I know have many, many shafts. It's perverse, but they're interested in what they can get out of the fewest. Now, I have a loom with 44 shafts.
Wow.
And I'm very curious about what you can do with two. I have a folder on two-shaft weaves. Many of us are funny about that.
Well, also, I think it's kind of nice for beginners, too, to know that there are a lot of things you can do on two shafts. You don't need 44 to do an interesting fabric.
Right. I think it's really good for people to know that four can keep you going forever.
Oh, yeah. Well, just look at Marguerite Davidson's book. I mean, you could spend your whole life going through that book.
Right.
Are there any weavers whose work inspires you?
Yes. Kay Sekimachi, Jack Lenore Larson, Ann Richardson, Ann Sutton, Jan Langdon. Jan Langdon does color and structures. Ann Sutton is from England, has written those books, and they're just wonderful. I have two of them, two copies, because they're too precious to me in case one gets lost. But the British study weaves and weaving in a way that is, they're looking to make cloth, but it's beautiful cloth. We just don't even go there. And Ed Richardson did the collapse workshop that I took.
Oh, right, yeah.
And she studied that for her master's or her thesis. Yeah. Her stuff is just beautiful. Mm. She was good about teaching the principles of what you need to know, too.
So you mentioned Helen Pope.
Oh, Helen. Helen died a few years ago when she was 95. And she was weaving up till the last few months. She wove big afghans. I have one over on the sofa. She would never sell them. She would give them. And you had to ask. That was hard. But they were beautiful. And she started weaving, and she taught soldiers who were at Letterman Hospital during World War II. Mm. She carried around little structo looms on her arm. Do you want to weave? Oh, no. And then they'd come around, but in those days, 40s and the 50s, they wove cloth. They knew their structures, and they had lots of interesting yarns, and a lot of people wove. In fact, Jim Ahrens made his living making looms and selling yarns and teaching, until daytime TV came in. Then his business went flat, he said.
That's interesting.
So then he had to weave for himself, and he wove a lot of ecclesiastical things, and he wove for Gump's, which is a fancy store downtown. He wove miles of placemats and peasant skirt fabrics that were probably plain weave with like a overshot pattern out of embroidery floss. Instead of using embroidery floss, he used sewing thread for the pattern.
Oh, yeah. Well, you've woven with sewing thread,
oh,
too.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, he said you can get a lot of shades.
Yeah.
I have a little bowl of them over there on the desk I'm thinking of using. When I go to New York, I go to the garment district and get them.
Oh.
If I want a red, I'll get two reds. I get two of everything, two that aren't quite the same.
Yeah.
They're real close.
That's a nice effect when you mix colors that are very similar.
Yeah, and if you have big fat yarns, they don't mix as easy as little fine ones. Then I'm making up my yarns. A lot of times I don't use them singly. I might use on my doubling stand, and I have many tips in my website on the doubling stand. a lot of pictures of it and how to make one yourself are in the third book.
I know on your website you always have a tip of the month. Is mm-hmm. there a particular tip you'd like to give for new weavers?
I think it relates to what Helen told me, you don't know mm-hmm. enough. There's all kinds of weaving mm-hmm. for all kinds of our heads. Some like to work with their fingers and they don't like to plan ahead. They like to do intuitive there. Some like to plan. And maybe they will or maybe they won't weave it. And there's all in between. Some like color, some like structure, some like wool, some like silk. If you like some kind of weaving, there's probably going to be a kind that will suit you. And you do not have to learn all of the weaves. After you've learned a few weaves, then you kind of want to do some of those over again. Mm-hmm. That's the thing I learned about weaving at the beginning that I liked. Mm-hmm. You'll never use it up.
Definitely something for everyone.
Yeah.
Why do you keep going back to teaching beginners?
It's what's available. But I love the beginners. I do mm-hmm. love seeing them knowing nothing and then making things.
And it's also nice seeing the ones who do really just take to it immediately mm-hmm. and see that spark.
Yes. And to acknowledge the unsparked ones mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah. They won't. They probably won't ever look at a bolt of fabric again the same way.
Exactly. One thing that Helen Pohl did, she would make two afghans, two on a warp. It might be the eye color of a grandson. It might be the sky one day. A lot of times it came from nature mm. or a flower. Mm-hmm. That's where she'd get her color schemes. And then one would use the same wefts as the warps, and then the other one she would use something different. And that's where I like to play too. Mm-hmm. Maybe a different hue, but the same value in those places.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember you saying that Helen liked to tie on a new warp at the end.
Yes,
yeah,
she did.
She had the same threading.
Yes. Near the end of her life, she wanted to make one more for a special friend, mm-hmm. and the cats had gotten onto it.
Uh-oh.
She found the original draft, and we mm-hmm. went through thread by thread, her in the front and me in the back, mm-hmm. making the repairs. And she had 16 shafts, and I think one of them she didn't use, so I think she used 15. She never rethreaded that as long as I knew her, from 65, 64, mm-hmm. till she died in 2000.
And she just kept tying on mm-hmm. new warps at the end.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, she always tied in front of the reed, and she had mohair and wools and all kinds of things. And when I watched her beam the warp, all those threads had to drag through the reed yeah. and drag through the heddles. Mm-hmm. It was a big challenge. But she used all those colors because she went from the front. Mm-hmm. I may not have used all those colors because I go from the back.
Right. Yeah, that is the one thing people who are dedicated front-to-back warpers always say is, you know, you can design in the reed, mm-hmm. which, you know, I guess we can design in the rattle.
We can design in the rattle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think are some of the advantages of warping back to front?
Well, it's just so good for fragile threads. I mean, I think spinners particularly can make their own, spin their own warps mm-hmm. because the threads don't go through the heddles and the reed twice. Mm-hmm. They just go through once and they're under tension. Mm-hmm. So to drag them through just doesn't make sense to me. And also, often I've seen huge tangles in front of the reed where people are threading. I went to FIT in New York, and they were doing double weave. One warp was sprinkled here and there, throughout the reed. Another warp was sprinkled in between here and there. There were two chains, and there were messes hanging from the reed.
Yeah.
Jim taught us the only thread that can't tangle is one under tension. The whole warp gets beamed up, it's under tension, then you can thread and you don't have tangles and messes and broken threads. One student, when I was teaching somewhere, said, oh, I just pray when I warp the loom. I said, we don't want to pray. We want to know how to do it. We mm-hmm. want to feel comfortable that our way is going to work. Front to back will work sometimes. So what I would think, teach the advanced weavers front to back, but teach the beginners back to front, mm-hmm. a way that they can always fall back on. And I always hear people say, well, that's the way I learned first. So they do fall back on mm-hmm. that.
More about your books. You're really doing a service for the weaving community. I think it's a set of books that belong on almost every weaver's shelf, just because you can pick it up and you think, oh, well, what do I do now? And you can look, and it's a good encyclopedic reference.
Well, thank you. That's kind of what I'm hoping. You know, I'm hoping that it'll help preserve hand weaving.
Mm-hmm.
My first idea was a big book like Collingwood's book. Well, then I figured I could never afford that, and nobody'd ever pay for it, and it'd never get done. Having it done in the three parts really made it doable. So the first one is on making the war and planning and set. Big chapter on set.
Yes.
I think that's a really good chapter.
Yeah.
The thing that people don't know about. That I learned from Jim. That's what industry uses. And the second one is putting it on the loom and all about looms and how to adjust those counterbalance. So I needed that because there were all those counterbalance looms at school, and I was afraid of them. I had to learn how they worked. And countermarch. I figured if I learned all there was to know about it, then I would know everything. Well, that's a mistake to think you're going to know all there is to know about something.
Mm-hmm.
But I know a lot. And then tying on new warps, I think, is wonderful in that second book. And the chapter on knots is good. Then the third book is weaving. It had to be done, and it was the biggest struggle. That has a lot on weaving and selvages and shuttles and end delivery shuttles. My favorite chapter is the drafting chapter because that was all mine. Everything else was pretty much Jim's, except the finishing came from a variety of people, and that's a big chapter, too. People say, well, what's next? That there isn't anything next. I've said all I need to say because now I want to weave.
Well, that's good. So if people want to get your books, they're available from a number of retailers and Amazon?
Amazon yeah. has them, and Halcyon and Yarn Barn mm-hmm. and Village Spinning and Weaving, Manning's. Mm-hmm. You can get them from any yarn shop. And I made a DVD and a video.
Oh, yeah.
People said that's really a big help. Virginia took it home. She missed the day in class mm-hmm. when we did the beaming. She came and did it by her own self. The website, www.weaving.cc. It's not .com, it's .cc.
Okay. Yeah. And you have a tip of the month?
Yes. Those are things from the book usually, although this time I'm going to have one from Dick Lindell. He has an adaptation for the end delivery mm-hmm. shuttle.
Thank you.
And it's been fun. Thanks a lot.
What's really cool about this interview is all about passing on weaving knowledge. Nancy learned from Peggy. And Peggy talks about her teachers. And in the Teach a Friend to Weave contest, Nancy told me about the students she's taught. Weaving knowledge is like a chain, and each of us learns from a weaver, and each of us passes it on. And I think that's what it's all about. I mean, making cloth and learning new things is wonderful. But it's really about taking knowledge from one person, making it your own, and then passing it on. That's all for this episode, and now it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you've got to be warped to weave. WeaveCast is partially funded by grants from the Hand Weavers Guild of America and the Seattle Weavers Guild, and our sponsor for this episode is Heritage Spinning and Weaving. The remainder of our funding comes from the generosity of donating listeners. This episode, I'd like to thank Erica, Catherine, Jan, Reagan, and Barbara. The ambient music for this episode was Guru Rabbi Teacher by Secret Archives of the Vatican. And we also played a vocal clip from Teaching and Learning by Acoustifilm. As always, our theme song is Limerick Rake by Celtic Reboot. For more information about these bands, please see the show notes, and I'd like to thank them for sharing their talents on the PodSafe Music Network.